Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Back. I have a voice now. I bowed out purely. I was in the house last week, but I couldn't talk. But now I can.
It's haunting the house.
haunting my own house.
Mr. Justin Robert Young.
We couldn't make it happen. You were downstairs. I was in your studio doing the show.
Dude, in my defense, my voice was pretty legit trashed. And in fact, if you see the Scam School episode, we shot the open and close that next day, and it still sounds, I sounded like Tom Waits trying to be all like, you know, get ready for Scam School.
Tom Waits.
As he did the Pat Oswalt bit of Fudge the Whale.
Give me a free beer.
We've got a interesting situation going on right now, and as we delve into this, I want to make it clear that all of our thoughts and, you know, were with the families and the people who of the Malaysian airliner, and whatever idiotic things come out of my mouth and everybody else's mouth, please understand that, you know, this is a real situation and real people are involved, and it's very, very heartbreaking to see, you know, this unfold. That being said, this Malaysian airliner, guys, you want to talk about weird.
Man, I'll tell you what, and I'm glad you said that right up front, Andrew, because there was some part of me that really kind of twinged when I saw the byline or the first line on some article is like, as if it's a Agatha Christie mystery, who done it? And I was like, MF-er, these people really died and there's real families.
Well, or did they? I mean, because here's the element of it that's so fascinating. And like, so last Tuesday we're doing the Night Attack podcast and I'm talking with Brian about prep and I'm like, oh, well, because we have this Alex Jones story we're going to tell. What if we went and do a thing about theories on the Malaysian airliner thing? And this is before the plot has thickened, which we will get into the newest news in a second. And Brian's like, no, come on. Like, it's just they died. They went down. We just don't know how it happened. Like, let's just stay away from it. And so we did. But now I think there is every element that was fed into that initial curiosity of maybe they're alive has been buffered by this latest news
in mind also that discussion was on a comedy podcast and I couldn't figure out what would be funny about it because we're so close to the tragedy, but on a mystery oriented podcast, I feel like this is absolutely fair game for speculation and discussion.
Well, we have here a, you know, if you look at how news cycles work and how immediately after a news cycle, you get a little bit of detail. And then everybody rushes to form opinions and theories. And then you get a little more details. And sometimes people walk back some of those with the mystery widens. And here was a case that we all expected that it was going to be, you know, we would, you know, the plane would probably be found, that maybe it would have been a bomb that went off and that it wouldn't have been that hard, not difficult, but, you know, using the resources at play, the plane would have been found at some point. And then, you know, we find out that the flight data, there was more data than they realized, that this plane actually kept going 7 hours after it was left the flight path.
How do they figure that out? I suppose, like, the, and keep in mind, I've not been paying attention, so I'm going to tell you what I hope will be the everyman's perspective. We know that the plane went down. We don't know where it is. We haven't been able to find it. The new news, as you guys just told me, is that it went for 7 hours, but I assume the goal is once we get the black box, the mystery will be solved, theoretically, right?
No. Once we get the plane. I mean, we don't know.
Obviously, we don't know that it went down.
The plane ran out of fuel at some point. So the plane left its flight path, which had been under some control, either the pilot or somebody taking over the plane. It left its flight path, turned off a number of the communications equipment, but there was still a ping that was sent to satellites, but they couldn't use it to track it. And that kept going for 7 more hours. And so originally they were looking within a narrow corridor along the flight path, but now they realize this thing could be 7 hours in any direction around there. And attention's now focused on the pilots to see there's been two prior incidences where pilots have used this as a means to commit suicide, which is actually mass killing and suicide. So, you know, and that's, it certainly needs to be explored, but I'm hesitant that we want to get too into that theory as a public, because if that's not the case, you know, you don't want to vilify somebody who doesn't warrant it.
Well, we do know that, and I think Malcolm Gladwell's books, I don't know if it's Outliers or what, but one of them talks about how, you know, mental health became a priority for pilots because so many pilots were, you know, they realized that of course, they can't kill themselves because it would bring shame upon their family or whatever, but there could be an accident. I'll tell you what this reminds me of. The fact that it flies 7 hours in some direction and... there was a plane that had some kind of pressure leak or something, and it dropped low enough that everybody passed out. And so this flight was on autopilot, just going in circles. And they scrambled fighter jets to find out what's going on. And according to one of the pilots in the fighter jet, they were able to see somebody sort of stumbling into the cockpit and sort of half-assed wave towards them and then lay down. And then basically, apparently, everybody just was asleep because they had just enough oxygen to live but not to maintain consciousness until eventually the plane ran out of fuel and crashed. Do you think this could be that kind of thing?
I went, no, that was a like a private jet, wasn't it?
No. I could have sworn it, and I'm sure the chat room will provide us with details on it.
Forget the golfer who was on like his.
Oh,
jet.
Is that the Stuart Payne?
No. That was in the United States, right? That was the exact same thing. But this one happened in Europe, and I want to say it was like a commercial airline or like a 737.
Yeah, I don't know anything about
that. Yeah,
those things are, you know, yeah. I think I'm not an aviation expert at all, so I have no idea. But you know that could be. You know, depressurization that it could keep it going. But again, it's the deviation from the flight path is the thing that's curious because it would have.
It shutting off the transponder, isn't there at least credible evidence to say that the communication devices were manually shut off inside
the
plane?
Yes, there was like a sequence that, you know, had to be intentionally put into play. So
because they didn't all happen at once. It was like one went down, so then another went down.
Intentionally take from by accounts from the intentionally turning off the communications equipment and turning the plane off the path.
And the only reason why we know about the satellite data is because that is something that cannot be turned off. That basically the connection between the satellite was just the plane communicating with the satellites to see whether or not it could get a better connection. So it was just like a digital handshake that was set to happen every like at certain intervals, and that's what we now know that was at least still happening for 7 hours after they lost contact with it.
So the prevailing theory right now is a pilot may have decided to ditch the plane, you know, decided to intentionally ditch the plane. That's a theory right now. It's the one, you know, the one we want to believe is that. And now is in the realm of possibility, which it wasn't before. So we want to believe that, you know, it landed somewhere and, you know, maybe the people are being, you know, held hostage for a meager ransom or something at some point, which we would have probably heard from them by now. But that would be the nice thing would be if these people were all alive, but probably not likely. But it's one of those things which just everybody, it's now considered, you know, probably the biggest mystery in aviation history.
Man, that's crazy. And we're 100% sure no Langoliers were involved in any way, right?
Nor Chris Christopherson.
No Millennium. No going to the future where you need to smoke cigarettes to stay healthy.
But it's, you know, think about this. It's 2014. We've lost an entire plane filled with people.
Well, and you know what? This is actually, I'm going to say these words, and please don't take them the way they sound, but instead the way I mean them. This is pretty rad that we live in an era where a single missing plane can be the biggest mystery of the year or whatever. Like it used to be planes went down so often. They're like, what can you do? It's a plane. You're heavier than air flying around. Of course it went down somewhere. And of course, you know, the reason that the Bermuda Triangle legend happens is because so many freaking planes kept going down. So many ships kept getting lost. That it was like, well, it's that's that whole area. Things just go away there. The fact that this is an anomaly, I could speak, weirdly makes me very proud of how far we've come in aviation advances.
Yeah, it's certainly, you know, one of those things where you think about how much we take for granted. You know, the idea that we would be able to know these things or understand what happened, and then we're presented with, hey, guess what? We don't know.
But I guess, man, it's so insane. It's so crazy to think of also like we have a hard time. And for somebody who flies a lot, you know, I have a hard time thinking like, okay, so let's say it is, let's indulge the hijacking scenario, right? And it is somewhere in a airfield in Yemen for whatever reason. How would you be able to not have anybody hold on to a cell phone to make a call? Like, how do you make sure that you get every piece of communications device? So literally nobody, if it is a hostage hijacking situation, like, how do you get all that communications out of their hands?
I would assume at some point, you know, the plane's going to be out of cell phone range unless somebody's carrying a satellite phone on them, you know, sure. And then you collect up phones. So I don't think that's a problem, but if it was a hijack situation, I think we'd have heard by now. And I can tell you eerily, I have a plot. I was going to do a plot in the Angel Killer series involving a plane going missing. In this case, it was going to be like Air Force One, and tried to think of plausible ways in which it could go missing. And
all right, well, walk us through some of the ideas that you had for a totally fictitious, non-tragic event.
My idea was to basically see what you could do if you could clone transponders and sort of give them the idea that it's going one place when in fact it's going someplace else.
And I guess that's the big question. If they did hijack it, and let's say somebody wanted to keep a plane and land it, odds are that there wouldn't be a conspiracy. You wouldn't have everybody, you know, continuing to agree to keep their mouths shut or whatever. You would have to, I guess, why would you capture a plane? What would you do with it? Like,
yeah, what could you do with a plane?
Okay, too? All right. So if they did capture a plane, they would have to replace the transponders, right? Is that something that's doable?
I mean, I guess it depends on what you want to do. Like, if you're going to use it to, you know, launch into a major city, you know, your biggest question is going to be, can you make it through airspace without getting shot down now, which would be more of a challenge.
I mean, that's the other thing, right? It's like now it doesn't even seem like that would make sense. I don't know. The whole I just don't see. It seems to me that terrorism is largely and I do not mean any disrespect to any victims of terrorism, but it's largely a PR campaign. It is a way to make a very loud statement. And in this case, nobody's claiming credit. Nobody's making a statement.
Yeah, that would, that's the thing that's, you know, that why it's, if somebody had tried to bring, I think that's part of this why they're looking at the pilots now, because nobody's taking credit for this. Nobody's saying we did this. And I will say that there was a plan in the 90s, the mid to late 90s, and another a prior Al-Qaeda plot to get a hold of a bunch of airplanes and then park them in the ocean. And that was pre 9/11. That was one of the, and we foiled that plan and said, well, you know, obviously we can outsmart these people, so, you know, we don't need to change the way
case
we do
closed.
Things. Yeah, exactly. It was like the first World Trade Center bombing. You remember, I got bombed once before. Some of the same parties involved were like, well, let's handle this as a state case. No need to go federal on this. Job done. We've dealt with these people.
They'll think twice before pulling one of these shenanigans again.
So we will see. You know.
Somebody in the chat room says, okay, despite all the possibilities, holler at Occam. Let's get his razor. Where are we at? And the thing is, like, I don't really know. Like, what is the Occam's razor on this, considering, like, the fact that we have it? I mean, normally we would find something in the ocean, right? Like,
right.
There have been plane crashes in deeper water, in choppier seas, that we have found stuff before, like, sooner than the timetable is at this point. At this point, the evidence from all the relevant authorities say that it is likely not crashed, at least where we thought it was crashed. Like, what is Occam's razor?
Occam's razor is a member of the flight crew deviated the plane off of its path for several hours into an area of which is much, much harder to search. And
yeah,
that's where it is.
But if that's the case, like you don't get any blowback from the co-pilot. You don't, the co-pilot doesn't say, hey boss, I'm not so cool with this idea. Like, that's the whole reason we have two capable pilots in every flight.
Incapacitate,
right?
The co-pilot. We've had this happened twice before.
Yeah.
You know, this has happened twice before. So, and again, I'm still innocent till proven guilty. Do not want to implicate the pilot or car. I want to be very, very careful of doing that. I'm saying that is the working theory right now. That's the one that most likely, that's what fits the available facts. We've had two prior instances of this happening. And it's, you know, you can lock the co-pilot out of the cockpit.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if, well, if you did that, I guess, okay, so so try this on for size. You lock, one party locks the other one out of the cockpit, knowing that he has, like, or maybe one party goes to the restroom, mm-hmm. and so you've got your 1 minute to shut down all communications and then lock the door. But in that case, once the door is locked and it's clear there's a scenario happening, like, there's everyone in the whole plane has to eventually try to beat this door down or negotiate with the guy. It's messed up. I don't know. Turns out this is hard. Maybe above our pay grade, gentlemen.
So you said we can consider this among the great mysteries of our or any era.
God, I just hope it's not one of those stupid unsolved mysteries that we talk about all the time on this show. I want it to be solved.
I think what's happening right now is they're pouring all over, you know, the pilot's history and his, what he may be agitated about, whatever, and then they'll develop a working theory that maybe he did that. We'll look for wreckage. And if we don't, you know, we come up with a theory that's comfortable, the theory that best fits the facts, and that's sort of what we kind of put in the little buffer and say, okay, this is probably what happened, and then we move on, whether or not that's the case or not. But, you know, eventually you have to call the search to an end. You have to use your resources and your investigators to do other things, and you just say, well, we think it was this. We have an explanation that fits the facts.
I mean, what is completely undeniable is how much this has captured the creativity and imagination of people around the world. I was in Detroit for a Go game, and I just turned on the radio, and it was on Detroit Sports Talk Radio. And instead of doing the sports talk of the day, the host of the show was literally just dedicating the entire show and the phone lines, which were lit up, to people's theories about this particular incident. And that was before we had authorities saying that it was definitely far off course, feeding some of the more wilder hijacking kind of models for it.
Man, that's so crazy. That's so bizarre. I don't even know what to say. It's like, it's tough to, I mean, I don't know. It's fascinating to think about. It's tough to want to be on the record saying, I think it's X, Y, or Z.
All right, gentlemen, let's change things up a bit. How would you like to live like a nomad, but a nomad in a nice, finely furnished apartment, a nomad that gets to visit a new country every week, nomad that may be able to take advantage of certain tax loopholes and not have to pay tax?
Well, all right, now you got my attention.
And the catch is, gentlemen, there is no catch. I just read about this yesterday. I've never heard of this before, but have you heard of World Ship?
Hold on, Brian.
World Ship.
Not the libertarian ship, but there's a ship called World Ship, and it's a big cruise liner. And what it is you buy a suite on there or buy a studio apartment there, and then you pay, you know, $60,000 a year or something like that for maintenance or whatever like this. And you own your suite, and this ship is continuously going around the world.
Oh my God. I just typed in World Ship Boat and
whoa, okay, hold on. So do you have to renounce? I mean, like, are you still a citizen of
still
the
a
country?
Citizen, whatever, but if you spend a year outside the United States, you don't have to pay income taxes.
Wait, is that the case? Because, like, I thought expats, I never paid attention. You know, we lived in Norway and my parents moved to Venezuela. And I don't know if it's a case of them. My dad worked for Conoco, mm-hmm. so my guess is they had some deal. Like, I thought I remember he had to pay both, but I guess if you're not taking money from an American corporation while you're out at sea.
Did he set foot in the U.S. at all during the year?
We'll say probably.
Yeah, if you set foot, if you don't set foot in the U.S., then you're allowed to, you know, it's like you're not paying income for that year.
So you'd have to see
if you wanted to come. You have to secretly set foot. It might be enough to hijack a Malaysian plane.
How many folks out there have? Like, how long can you not be in the United States and still be a U.S. citizen? Like forever?
Forever.
Wow. So I could just go live in Australia And then the moment something happens and never pay taxes, but then the moment some incident happens, be all like, you know, Uncle Sam, save me. Sim, sim, salabim. Come, Uncle Sam.
They may not come save you, but you know, you can ask.
All right. But I still have the protection and rights. The
Uncle Sam
benefits.
Would say,
the protection and rights that you have in a foreign country, which are none.
Well, they're not. I mean, they're clearly not none. I mean, we have embassies for the very reason of finding asylum and for, you know, we have international incidents because American citizens have been in foreign countries where people have been coming down on them.
But subject to the laws of the foreign country.
Yeah.
All right. Enough of this. World ship. Let's get back to this world ship.
Okay.
So, world ship. So what it is it's a big cruise liner, fancy cruise liner. They've got like 5 restaurants on there. They've got a little, you know, deli market. They've got, you know, all of the amenities you could want. And it's, you know, basically for they rumored, they don't tell you who's has, you know, who lives on it, but
is this like, it right here? I just did
aboardtheworld.com.
Aboardtheworld.com, residences at sea. Sailing past Baffin Island, we broke the record. The largest ship ever to traverse the Northwest Passage. I think it said like maximum of 200 people at any time or something. Mm-hmm. Do you want to see this video about life on board?
No, it's boring. Guests, people who live on there include Arnold Schwarzenegger, perhaps Madonna.
What?
Those are rumored. They don't actually tell you who lives there.
I guess part of what you are buying is anonymity.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is, you got to be kind of wealthy to live on board here.
It's a big ass boat. So, okay. So you got tons of money and they make sure to show an elegant 50-year-old woman. So you got tons of money. You buy yourself a station, like a suite permanently, or they do timeshares.
You buy a permanent suite.
Wow. That seems like a pretty sweet gig.
Okay. Somebody in the chat room is saying he's worked on the ship.
All what? Right. No way.
There are a few residences I have worked on the ship.
Okay. We need more juicy details than that.
Yeah.
Yes.
So far, we're seeing Zumba courses.
The hallways are nice. They've gone out of their way to not make it look like a cruise ship, meaning that it looks like a really nice high-end hotel. And,
yeah,
you know, you're going to be on board with a bunch of other very, very wealthy people, probably of an age that can afford to spend money and have decided they want to spend the rest of their life living on a cruise ship. But I looked at this and thought, like, man, this is a interesting example of, you know, is this what living on Mars or living in space or the future is going to be like?
Well, I guess certainly it's the best we can hope for living on Mars, except for you don't ever get to get out. I don't know. I guess you can walk out of the
dolphins,
the pods from time to time. But it's this is astonishing, man. It's a floating city of permanent residence, theoretically. Makes me feel okay about going to Mars. And I'll tell you what, I think about this all the time. Have you ever been to, there's these hotels, like there's one in Nashville, there's one in, I want to say like Grand Prairie or Grandview or something in Texas or whatever. The Gaylord hotels, the entire thing is a whole complex that is, we'll say like a giant cruise ship basically, but it's all completely enclosed. It's all atriums. You know, they have the trees growing inside or whatever. And I don't know how big it is. I really should have details for all this. But the entire thing, like you go to a convention there, you spend like 5 days straight. And at the end of the convention, you leave and you realize, son of a bitch, I never once set foot outside. And I never once felt choked or in a room or trapped or any of that stuff. And to me, I always thought about Mars with that. But this is exactly more of the same idea.
Yeah, this is like most of the shots are of people going and doing cool things off the ship.
Yeah.
And not staring at red rocks. I lived on a cruise ship. It's not. It's for a week or two. It's fine. After that, it's, you know, you go stir crazy. And that's like, I'm all for the colonization of Mars. I'm serious. Like, I'm not going until there's a Taco Bell. I'm not going until.
Yeah. Well, you're not going to go until there's a second colony. So you can say, screw this colony. I'm going to the other one.
I just think that the whole Mars One initiative, a bunch of people, we're going to go to Mars. We're going to live there. It's like, what are you're going to be living in a stinky, you know, trailer underground, you know, we've gone back and we're like, I'm like, you got to have a ticket back because you're going to go nuts thinking like I'm going to die here. Living so, in a fallout right, real shelter.
Quick, two things. That guy Rude, who said that he worked on the ship, said that he was part of a team that custom built spas and some of the suites on the ship.
By the way, that's the same. That's Dave, the same guy who made those custom BB marble awesome things. Yeah.
So that is we can confirm that is indeed his trade.
That's right.
So he says that it was very, very nice, not as nice as they make it seem, and that there was a lot of drama aboard.
Oh, my God. Which
you have to – I mean, like, there's drama in a neighborhood.
Well, and that's just it. Like, any enclosed space – and I think this has something to do with Dunbar's number, right? Like, you don't hear about the drama of living on Manhattan. People get murdered, and you're like, ah, will you sweep that away? I got to get to work. But it's like when you're in a small town or in a neighborhood, whenever you're in that enclosed space and you can almost know every single person around, that's – any of those situations, you get drama. You know, I worked at a summer camp teaching magic for a couple of summers, and it's drama central during all that.
Well, and you think that, like, too, it's like you're living there with a bunch of very wealthy, perhaps some feeling very entitled people.
Yes.
And used to having their way. Which,
and it's all fun and games until Schwarzenegger shows up and starts banging all the wives.
Yes.
Jerk. Way to go.
I mean, it's a great setting for a murder mystery.
Speaking of which, real quick sidebar on Schwarzenegger. Did you see his awesome Look at My Tank video?
I saw the headlines, but he's running over stuff.
Yeah, basically, it's just him saying, like everything until now doesn't matter because now I have a tank and I want you to get in it with me and let's run over stuff. And it's like he rents out his tank so that you can crush things with it. It's amazing.
Very cool. Yeah, I just saw the headline and Arnold and tank. I'm like, yes,
done.
I believe this.
This is
so.
This
all right. I mean, this is not this ship is not tremendously different than like people who, let's say, there's like huge enclaves in Mexico, right, with American expats that effectively live in American communities free of American taxes, so they can have their wealth spread further than they would otherwise. This seems like more of a luxury boutique option than that, but not dissimilar, you know, that you are going to get a different experience, and for a certain level of wealth you will have it spread you know, further and differently than you would in America.
I would say kind of the inverse. I mean, it's everything's much more expensive there, and these people aren't really doing it as a tax dodge. I mean, this is like, I think this is more, you know, because like you move to Mexico because to make your money go further. You go here, your money's not going to go anywhere near as far. But the idea of this, you have a place or you have a house that goes around the world.
What do you think the spread is as far as people who are permanent residents on the boat versus those who are, you know, come out for a month or two? Like your Schwarzeneggers versus your, you know, I don't know, your Maria Sanchez, who has $1 billion and nobody knows who she is and she just loves living on this boat.
I would bet that the ones that are more permanent are much older.
Yeah. You think it becomes almost like a like an assisted living kind of situation?
Retirement, yeah.
Yeah, like a safe area?
I think that would be, you know, you looked at the video and you look at the demographic they're appealing to. You know, these are people in their 60s, you know, that are, hey, why don't you just spend the rest of your money living on a boat?
Man.
That guy Root says that there were no permanent residents when he was aboard. It was all
not surprised.
Show up for a couple months. But I forget which one of you, or Brian, I think you said, you know, the person for whom nobody knows where their money comes from. That would be, like, Andrew, you talked about the setting for a murder mystery. All of a sudden now, it's like the you know, Michael Bloomberg is standing next to the person who paid their way to do it. Like, is there a condo board that's like, no, obvious drug dealer from Colombia?
They do. No, they actually have a process by which they approve or don't approve of, you know, people, criminal records, et cetera. They're very careful who they let live there.
Oh my God, this would be a perfect setting for a murder mystery. This really would be amazing, especially like I'm assuming that you could not get away with writing a book where Michael Bloomberg, Magic Johnson, Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and all these guys were on this boat for this party. Someone died, and then you told this whole story of which one did it. You're like, and the murderer was Barack Obama or whatever.
You could write that. It's fictional. Say whatever you want.
Really? And can use their names. They're not going to shut you down. Like,
you say this is a work of fiction, you know?
Oh, okay, but okay. Well, we've seen, and you know more about this than I do. Like, I know that Ernie Cline wrote Ready Player One, and because it was a book, he was able to fantasize about a DeLorean flying around with an X-Wing fighter, flying around with, you know, a light cycle from Tron or whatever. But when it came down to the reality of shooting it, they're like, yeah, you can't, when we make the movie, can't be this property, can't be that property, switch this movie to this movie because it's in our library or whatever. Are we far off from publishers refusing to touch? I understand that it's America and you're allowed to write whatever you want and you're allowed to sell it yourself, but there's a certain amount of very real trouble that publishers get into when they touch properties that are going to make trouble for them.
Well, in Klein's position, you know, it was descriptive and used enough of it, but not, you know, and yet it was in the context of going, oh, I'm going to go into this world and go do this thing or whatever. Once you want to put a DeLorean time traveling machine in a movie and you're violating the copyright by showing this thing that's been elsewhere or whatever, that's where it gets very problematic. If you keep it parody, I mean, that's how they do. If you can defend it as straight up parody, like Scary Movies or all those things do, that's different. But when it's clearly not, you know, that's the gray area. But in the case of a book, you can describe a lot of things. But if you start saying, well, no, this is Darth Vader doing this, this, and this, then like, no, you know, then you're using somebody else's, you're appropriating their character.
Yeah.
Although in general, bad form to make the president a murderer. Like, usually bad form.
Well, yeah. And to be honest, I picked that specifically for the controversial nature. I wanted to stir our audience up. Yeah, whoa, shots fired at Barack Obama. Let's forget I said any of this stuff.
I think it's great.
I hope you enjoyed our last episode from this house. I'm going to move to the world.
The world ship.
Yeah.
Dude, I think that would be awesome. I would love to just the drama on there. Like,
oh my God.
Especially because like you are kind of divorced of your power, right? Like part of being a rich person and your power structure is your effect on other people who are not as rich. If you are just getting into a screaming match with somebody else who is on your floor and they're also super rich, like what strings can you pull?
That's funny because like I think of it, the benefit of it being egalitarian from the perspective of like I'm somebody who has, you know, saved, we'll say $10 million and can finally, you know, go for a few months on this boat and look at me hobnobbing with Arnold Schwarzenegger's. But maybe there's a reverse side to it where Arnold Schwarzenegger's like, man, I'd just like to be just another schlub on a ship. I'd love to just, you know, have to complain about the salsa music playing at all hours up above me and then, you know, hit my broom up and then bang my house cleaner.
Well, yeah, I think certainly it's interesting looking at the drama that gets into that play. I knew a guy who was very, very wealthy. He was moved into a neighborhood and was wealthy mansion type neighborhood, and the guy who was sort of the tyrant of the neighborhood was this attorney who did like airliner lawsuits or tobacco lawsuits or something like that. You know, the attorney had millions of dollars, and he would, you know, threaten everybody in the neighborhood, you know, legally, whatever, you know, if your car was parked in the wrong spot, whatever. It was just a total jerk. This guy moves in, acquaintance moves in, and he puts a piece of sculpture in his front yard, basically to aggravate the attorney, and the attorney, you know, decides to, you know, file a lawsuit or whatever. Well, the attorney didn't realize the attorney was worth, you know, maybe $20-30 million in these lawsuits. This guy's worth $1 billion. Okay. He's have so much money now, his whole thing he looks for is people to screw with and mess with who he thinks are jerks. And so the attorney found out very quickly, like, guess what, you know, $10 million is not a lot of money. $1 billion, that's a lot of money, and that can afford a lot more, you know, legal action.
I'll tell you what, man. Once all of a sudden, it's like once you have $1 billion, I'd imagine it's like a cheat code on life where all of a sudden you do ridiculous stuff. All of a sudden, all of Minecraft goes into sandbox mode, and you just do whatever you want. Like, when you said that story just now, it made me think of that story of a guy who bought the house next to his ex-wife and erected a statue of a middle finger pointed towards her house. It's like this bronze statue that's lit at all 24 hours a day, lit and pointed at his ex-wife's house.
Yeah, it's basically
that was also famously, wasn't that Al Goldstein in
Al
Fort
Goldstein
Lauderdale?
That one too, yeah.
Oh, it was? Wait, you know this guy?
No, different guy.
This was long ago. This is back in the mid-90s, I believe. But Al Goldstein, famous provocateur and publisher of, was it Screw Magazine?
Screw Magazine.
Screw Magazine moved down to Fort Lauderdale and, being a famously disagreeable person, decided to erect a middle finger and have it pointed out to the Intercoastal, which is not only a place where tourists, you know, it is the water tax, you'll go through there and you can do a tour of all the homes, but also the most, you know, Fort Lauderdale is the yacht docking capital of the world. The Spielberg parks his yacht there. There's a lot of money, and it's not uncommon to have super rich people just have a house in Fort Lauderdale on the Intercoastal. And there was Al Goldstein with his gigantic middle finger sculpture just pointed out to the world's muddied elite.
I actually, it's weird that this comes to this, but I had to explain all of this to my 10-year-old Penelope today because she's tired. And follow me into parent land for a little bit, right? We're in the minivan coming back from having watched Mr. Peabody and Sherman. And Penelope has announced that Josie is not allowed to watch Chippendale's Rescue Rangers because she's so tired and fed up and it annoys her so much. And so we spent like the whole 20-minute ride with me arguing, explaining that all of America was founded on the idea that you don't get to tell other people what they can and can't enjoy, no matter how annoying it is to you. And Penny was like, you know, like, but Penelope is all like, this psychological damage, it's not fair.
Well, you get to tell people, we just don't have to listen.
That's right.
Yes.
Tell them all you want. Well, gentlemen, do you want to do one more?
Yeah, I got I'm into this.
All right. Do you want happy? Do you want dark?
I feel like we could use some happy right about now.
All right.
Man, I was going to go dark.
Okay, you know what? Let's go dark. Let's just make this the dark episode.
All right. So
stick with the theme. Why not?
You ever like read something and you're like, I did not know that. And I'm like, wow, I wish I kind of didn't know that.
So you're talking about like knowledge that's a stain on your brain that you can't unknow.
I would say to a degree. So if you ever go get a blood test and they want to test for like to see like if you have a bacteria or whatever, they apply a little agent in there and the agent will start to like coalesce and form little globules, right? Okay. And it's a very quick best way we have, which is one of the best ways to use to test for like foreign bodies, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Do you know where this agent comes from?
Oh man, I'm not going to like this. I don't know, but an immediate. All right, I don't know. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay, so when you watch, you know, when you think about things that we need to be sympathetic towards, you know, we think about like you know, cuddly kittens and abandoned animals, and you know the Sarah McLachlan, you know, song "Arms of an Angel" plays, you know, and you want to cry. But I'm like, I'm convinced now that like I could play that song with like, you know, the rally in Nuremberg or something with Nazis or something, like, and you might still cry, you know, like, oh, they're gonna die. It's like,
beautiful song. Beautiful song.
It's a beautiful song. But anyhow, imagine this: you're laying on the beach, enjoying the sun and the breeze, a little bit of views in the water, and all of a sudden you get picked up, thrown in the back of a truck with a bunch of others.
Okay.
Right. Remember War of the Worlds? Remember the modern version where like they're harvesting the people and then like draining them, right?
Yeah.
Kind of imagine that situation, right? You get picked up, hauled up, put on a rack, something jabbed into your body. They start pumping out 30 to 40% of your blood till you're near death. Then they scoop you back up and throw you back out there on the beach.
This is like blue crabs or something, or
horseshoe crab.
Oh, I was so close. Damn it.
So apparently that's where we get this agent from, is it's the blood of horseshoe crabs. But, and we have people who go along, scoop up horseshoe crabs out of shallow water, throw them in the back of the truck, take them to a factory where they just strap them to it, literally strap them to a big long rack, shove a little pipe into them, and it starts pumping out blood until we get 30, 40%, pull it out, throw them back in the ocean.
Now, so they survive,
Mostly, yes.
Mostly.
Yeah.
Their blood is blue.
We get a huge medical advancement.
Yeah, I mean, it's necessary. It's just freaking bizarre. I read about this, the whole industry of horseshoe crab bloodletting.
Oh, it's my, like, good God.
You know, you watch in vampire movies and stuff about how, you know, like, oh, there's the harvesting house for blood, or maybe blood banks really serve that. Like, if you're a horseshoe crab, like, what a nightmare.
Well, and I guess the question is which is the more humane approach, right? Like, I mean, we have, again, it's like we have entire farms where we raise vertebrate mammals for the explicit purpose of slaughtering them, tearing apart their corpses and eating them. But I know they're delicious, but the, like, is it somehow worse? I guess it, I mean, number one, it is weird that, like, of all things, horseshoe crabs, and that we don't even grab the whole thing. We don't have horseshoe crab farms. We just run out and pick them up off the ground and steal their blood and run away laughing.
No, I think it's, yeah, listen, if we're in the scheme of things, you know, I would rather be a party to that transaction than, you know, walk into the slaughterhouse and end up in, you know, on my plate. But it's just to say that, wow, what a weird, bizarre thing. I had no idea that was this major industry of taking these horseshoe crabs, strapping them down, pulling out their blood, and then releasing them. And again, that's great. Good. They get to go back out. But that's the thing that's like, that fascinates me. It's like, you're like, hey, I'm a wild animal. I'm free. I'm like, oh, I'm caught. They got me. Ugh. Yeah, oh my God, what's this? Like, you're being abducted by aliens. You're like, oh, what's this?
Boom, I mean, boom. This is the alien abduction archetype, right?
Yeah, yeah, it is.
And then they pull it out, and you're like, I'm so weak. Now what? Now you're going back out. I'm going. You let me free? Yeah. Oh my God. Thank God.
All the other horseshoe crabs.
Crab's trying to tell all the other crabs, no, seriously, they had five fingers, and they picked me up.
No, there's like a barrier up above, and there's like no water around. It's crazy.
Multiple suns.
That's right. man, that sucks for the crab.
Yeah, so
it's awesome for us.
Crabs,
so
ma.
I want to give a thanks to all the horseshoe crabs out there.
Yo, this one's going out to you, crabbies.
Fighting big disease. And so, just as you know, part of the reason we use is like horseshoe crabs, like, you know, because
put
they
your
live
claws
in
the air for those crabs.
They don't
really
have those kind of pincers, but, you know, we can like skitter.
I want an animated GIF of Andrew doing the skitter dance.
So, I was on a location once, and somebody had, like, hurt their leg, and the nurse on location's like, oh, we're by the ocean. Go wash it in the ocean because it's got healing properties. And I'm like,
what?
Are you kidding me? Like, do you know what bacteria and what stuff lives right out there, you know? And it was like, how are you a nurse? If you think that, and we'll forget that we're just a couple miles away from an outflow plant from sewage. I was just, and it's like horseshoe crabs, we use their blood because they live in a very hostile, germ-filled environment, you know, and that's why we use it, because they've had to develop this adaptation to be able to survive.
Jeez.
So I don't know. I just was like, wow.
So we've learned the greatest mystery the world has ever known is the Malaysia 370.
Certainly the greatest aviation mystery in history.
We've learned that Arnold Schwarzenegger is coming for your wife if you decide to sail around the world full time.
In his tank.
In his tank. And we've learned that oceans are cesspools, yeah, and that we are bleeding the world's horseshoe crab population so we might live longer.
Feel like we've done a lot of good.
Yeah.
Well, just to follow up, because we mentioned it on last week's episode, is there an update on the SpaceX launch?
It's been today? Postponed to the 30th.
The 30th. Okay.
30th. So we would love to, if they were going to do it this weekend, I was actually going to try to do a live cast last night. But if they go do the SpaceX launch on the 30th, I would love to try to broadcast that live. It was going to be like 4 a.m. but
ooh,
Eastern. So 1 a.m. Pacific.
Yeah, that's easy.
Yeah, I'm wide awake at that time.
Easy peasy.
Should we do picks?
Yeah, man.
Let's pick it up.
Anybody want to start?
I'll start.
Yeah, go for it.
So I saw a couple really awesome movies, and one of them is going to be the pick, and that is the Veronica Mars movie. Really one of the great stories in kind of our ever-shifting – the ever shifting sands of entertainment. The Kickstarter brought in about $5.7 million, of which I would think it was a very happy hundred. They released it. They had some technical kerfuffles with its distribution method, but I applaud Warner Brothers for doing the right thing. And eventually they said, even though their preferred method was Flixster, which they own. And I watched it on Fine, to be fair. But if you hate it and it sucks, which apparently it did for a lot of people, you can just buy it on Amazon or iTunes and they would rebate you the money if you provided them the receipt. I saw the movie. It was really, 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 really good from my perspective as a fan. I loved it. I would recommend it to other people that liked the show. I would recommend it to people that didn't like the show because I thought the mystery was really well done. And as with the show itself, the acting and the writing was top notch. So it was really satisfying to see one of these projects that were huge and public to end creatively, at the very least, if not financially. And we'll see as those chips continue to fall. To end so successfully. So I very much loved it. My pick is, if you have not seen the Veronica Mars movie, if you just followed the Kickstarter and didn't back it, go buy it. I think it's in theaters for the rest of the weekend. I don't know exactly what their plan is going forward, but I was a huge fan of it.
Do you think that it would appeal to someone like me who never watched a single full episode of Veronica Mars ever?
You know, they go through some backflips to kind of set it up as an independent story. And I would be curious to see what people who had not seen it think of it. There are certainly enough Easter eggs for the fans and little winks and nods for, that bring back old characters. So I think you probably would. There's probably enough of those points where, like, a joke lingers for a half second more than it would otherwise for somebody who had never seen it, because the rest of the audience is like, oh, that's the guy.
Would you say it's analogous to seeing Serenity if you had never seen Firefly?
Probably. Yeah. I think that's a very good, I think it's, there are people I'm sure who have seen Serenity that then made them want to go watch the rest of Firefly because they got, the crackle of the cast and the writing and they enjoyed that. Even if they understood that that's not the full experience. And I think that would probably be the same with this one. And then I'd like to just real quick say, I love the to piggyback on Andrew's pick last week, I love the Grand Budapest Hotel. And the further I get away from it, the more it rises on my Wes Anderson list, because it is probably, it's the most coherent. It's certainly the first mystery he's straight up ever done. And I kind of love it for all of the nuances that he brings there, which is not necessarily something that he's done before. And I love that.
Where do you place it on the Wes Anderson ladder?
I think I like it. It's probably third behind Tannenbaum's and Rushmore. Those have been my 1-2 forever, and I think I like it. I think it's for
more than Moonrise.
More than Moonrise, and not to knock Moonrise, because I love Moonrise, but it's the first time that the story has mattered as much as the characters.
Better than Wes Anderson, the Fantastic movie. Mr. Fox.
That is something that it remains a blind spot for me. I still haven't seen Fantastic.
Well, and I'll be the first to admit that it's sort of like we talked at the beginning of the episode, like you have to put an extra star in if you have kids and you get to see the wonder on their faces as they watch it, Like when those credits hit at the end and Penelope jumped up and started dancing in the aisle, it was like, all of that certainly colored my experience. But Fantastic Mr. Fox might be my all-time favorite Wes Anderson film.
And that's not a controversial opinion. I mean, a lot of people who don't have kids and watch their children dance in the aisles as the credits roll, I think, think very highly of that movie. But it is, Grand Budapest Hotel is a movie where you kind of care about where the story resolves more so than just how these characters are going to interact with whatever hurdles are put in front of them. And it's rare for a Wes Anderson movie because he does character so well, and generally the aesthetics of the film are enough, to hang around the characters, but this is not that. And I love it.
Andrew, you want to go?
Sure. Now, just a quick touchback. Having watched the finale of True Detective, I totally support my previous endorsement to True Detective, the series. I was impatient with it at first, then grew interested, and by the end of it, absolutely loved it. And I think it's iconic television that we'll be talking about for years to come. I think it changed television. And I don't want to set your expectations too high, but the idea of one writer, one director telling 8 hours or 7 hours of a narrative is kind of unheard of. And, you know, I thought the result was very, very good. I will say real quick, those of you who have Netflix, Clone Wars, Star Wars Clone Wars, the series, the entire series there and the wrap-up season are available on there now. And I mean, kind of, I've had some of the Clone Wars DVDs before and I've been working my way through, and there's a lot I like about this series. I'm not a cartoon guy per se, but my crit with this series, it's a god awful lot of people standing around in council chambers arguing, and then it's just quick, let's have a fight, you know, a sword fight or laser blast fights. But there is some really good storytelling in there, and it's so far enjoyable, although it can put me to sleep at times.
So that's your pick is Clone Wars?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to Rebels, Star Wars Rebels. I think Star Wars Clone Wars started off with this is what it's going to be about, and they followed that vision. And I think Star Wars Rebels is saying, okay, knowing what we know now, technology and storytelling, let's go from there. And so I'm super excited about Rebels to see where that goes.
The showrunner for Clone Wars was the only person I ever heard talk when I was at Star Wars Celebration that made me think about the prequels in a different way. Like, he had a very interesting
David Filoni
on what was that?
Filoni?
Yes, Filoni.
Yeah.
He had a very interesting take on the larger themes of the prequels. So much so that I went to a why we love the prequels panel that he was on. And as I was talking to Brian, I'm like, man, like, I actually think I'm going to see it. I think it's going to be a really cool thing. And Brian's like, what? It's going to be a bunch of people saying, it was awesome when Yoda fought. Like, and then I walk in. And it's like, literally, I walk in. It's like, and I think the best part is when Yoda fought. And everybody cheered, and I just walked right out. It was like, all right, you won, Brian.
Did I tell you, how the longest prank I ever pulled was on a friend that I had convinced that, that I got to see advances of the first movie of Phantom Menace. So a buddy and I, we wanted to prank this guy. We're always doing pranks back and forth. So we came up with this whole idea, this whole story that we were leaving a movie theater and we got pulled aside by some Lucasfilm people and they were screening some clips from, you know, before anybody had seen Phantom Menace of the movie. And we described to him, we said, listen, they made us sign all these confidentiality agreements. We can't even tell you, but because you're our buddy, we'll tell you, but you can't tell anybody what happened. And we described a way better movie than, we had, there were scenes in there, Jedi rising out of the ground and the storylines. We gave him this really, really, and he was just totally hooked on it, right? And then what we did a year later, I had my buddy call him up and say, hey, because planted a seed, buddy of mine planted a seed, like, oh, you know, when they're at that casting, Andrew didn't tell you, but they were doing an open casting for Anakin, for the adult Anakin, and they asked Andrew for his contact info. And so my friend's one of the people who would believe anything, anything that negatively, that meant like a bad outcome for him. And then and he says, so did anybody talk to you about cast? I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. And so
No. When you said that, you genuinely didn't know what he was talking about,
he was talking about.
Okay.
I played up the whole, I don't know what you're talking about. So anyhow, so my friend started feeding him stuff he got invited out to go to go to the Skywalker Ranch to go do a screen test. My friend calls me up and goes are you going somewhere next week? I go, I really can't talk about it. So we had him, and then we basically, the day before, the trailer comes out, and you get to see the first trailer, because we knew once the trailer was out, he would know everything we said was a complete lie. The day before the trailer comes out, we're waiting in line. We go, we lied to you about everything.
And did he believe it, or was he doing that even more horrific?
He was pissed because he told everybody. He told everybody all the scenes in the movie, all the stuff we described to him.
In which case, he got what came to him because you told him, don't tell nobody. And then he went off and squawked.
Yep, that was it. So,
man, that must have been an awkward beginning of Wing Commander when the first prequel trailer aired.
Watching Meet Joe Black or The Water Boy. So I wanted, before I give my pick, I want to give a nod to a previous pick that I'm actually re-experiencing again right now. You guys heard me talk about friend of the show's Patrick Rothfuss's Name of the Wind. I went back and started re-listening to it, mainly because very rarely do I go back and re-listen to an audiobook. But what's nice about it when you do that is that, like, if you fall asleep midway, you don't feel the need to go back and hear every word. You're like, oh, yeah, I know what happened. It's astonishing how deeply back into the story I am. And this go-round, I started playing it, the beginning of it, for Penny, my 10-year-old, and she is walking around with one of our old iPhones on speaker at all time, playing this audiobook, narrating Name of the Wind to her. So, so completely good. But that's not my pick. My actual pick is a video game that just came out, and I was late to jumping into it. I knew it was going to be good. I heard good things about it. I thought of it as a console game. And then finally, I realized I could get it on PC, and it was, you know, traditionally PC games don't tend to be $60, but this one was, because EA sucks. But I'm so glad I went ahead and bought it yesterday. It's Titanfall. It is such a cool, well-balanced Team Fortress 2-like game. It's a run-around, shoot-em-up, first-person shooter, but they have gone out of their way to figure out, how do experienced people play these kinds of games and what's satisfying to them? How do inexperienced people play these games and what's satisfying to them? What is something that everybody likes? And the way the game plays is you have two factions. You got some corporate overlord faction, and you have the militia, the local troopers trying to rebel. And every game starts with about 2 minutes of just everybody running around as individual players. But the more the other guys you shoot, the more time you chip off the amount of time until your Titan arrives. And at some point, they start, you know, you're running around shooting them. They got guns that are made for if you're kind of a noob or you're not so good at first-person shooters, it does this this auto-lock thing, so you don't have to worry about, you know, hitting them in the head or whatever. And then at some point it says, you know, your Titan arrives in 10 seconds. And then out of nowhere, this giant mech falls down right next to you, reaches over. You're able to, you know, picks you up and shoves it in his chest, and now you're just a mega badass for, you know, two things. One, on the one side, it's great to have all this power and run around and blow up and step on people, but meanwhile, you have a giant target painted on you the entire time that you're playing as a Titan. Really, really fun.
Say that Titan falls?
It's Titanfall. really, really enjoying it. Looking forward to playing a lot more.
I've heard nothing but great stuff about it. I've heard that it's as far as a game that people who are non-gamers may find a love for. I've heard that the art and it's so cinematic. It's amazing looking. I mean, just so beautiful. And I might be tempted to play.
Yeah, there's a bit of a story in there, similar to the way StarCraft II had a story, where it's like as you're playing the game, you can't help but hear the cross chatter between different factions talking or whatever. And so plot elements will evolve. You'll find out who betrayed whom, that kind of thing. But to be able to do all of that in a gameplay style where every single time you play the game, you're playing against other real people. And even when your team loses, they make a mini game out of like, okay, now our team has lost. Now for the next 30 seconds, the mini game is get to the dropship without getting killed, and you'll get more bonuses for having stayed alive at the time. So it's like they thought of every aspect of it. So no matter how it goes, you still get experience points that level up and open up more options and stuff. Really smart stuff.
So do you see that Sony, I think maybe this week or coming up, is supposed to be announcing their version of an Oculus type Rift?
No, that's awesome.
So we'll see if it's
the more the better.
Better than previous offerings, and if it's not just vaporware, but we're fast approaching that era of trying to come out with competitively, you know, really good VR headsets. So,
and I'll tell you what, we're not that far away from so many things that seemed outrageous in the snow crash era. Like on the ride home, I realized, like, in the movie, spoiler alert, I don't know if this is a spoiler, but in Mr. Peabody and Sherman, whenever they're doing a party, they're all humming the theme to, or the song Brazil, right? And and so it got stuck in my head, and on the ride back, I was like, man, I'd love to just play this for, oh, geez, I just read what you wrote, Andrew. As we're riding home, I was like, oh, I should play that song for the kids. That'd be fun because they would recognize it from the movie. And I realized that the inconvenience, while we have the technical ability for me to connect my phone to the car, for me to open up Spotify, for me to find the song and do it or whatever, we're not that. And separately, I have the ability to tell Siri to do a limited number of things. I mean, what are we, like maybe 2-3 years from me being able to say, hey, play Brazil. That'll be fun. And then it just popping right on. Like, I mean, that's Jarvis level stuff that is right around the corner.
Well, can't you do that now?
Well, I mean, the problem is it's not integrated, and again, all the pieces similar to all the things you could do.
It's not just like always on.
Correct.
It's not just like Jarvis play Brazil.
Right.
Like you have to hit a button or you have to do a thing, and it's like yes, that's the half step that takes it from amazing utility to omnipresent magic.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, like in my car with my Bluetooth and a hookup, I can press a button and say that, and it'll do it.
Well, wait, a song you don't have on your phone?
Oh, that I don't have on my phone.
Right, again, like all those pieces, like Spotify, you can open up Spotify on your phone and you can find it and play that particular song or whatever. It's
gotcha.
Just it's the integration that's just right around the corner. We have all the pieces. We just need to see all of it happen at once.
It's fascinating because it's like the difference between Google Now and Siri is like. I think Google Now is fantastic, but when you run up against the wall, you hit that wall hard, and it's like Siri. When you run up against that wall, you're running that wall hard, and you're like, man, it's like, you know, I'll give the edge to Google Now for a while, but then I'll ask it for some data, and I'm like, no, this is totally incorrect. It just did a Google search and played something back for me that was correct 6 months ago or something. So, you know, but still amazing.
Yeah, it's insane. I, from here on out, it's really just a matter of fidelity. It's just gonna, one day we're gonna look up and be like, oh, all that crap's solved. And it's, it is that easy all the time.
Gentlemen, it's been weird.